So as Barbara pointed out, I used to be a teacher. So when I ask questions, I kind of expect an answer, but I'm also willing to stand here until I get one. So another fair warning. So I'm going to start off with two questions. The first, so when Jesus is talking about the law in the passage I just read, what law is he referring to? Say that again. I think I heard the Ten Commandments, was that right? Okay, that's part of it. The law of what? Laws of God. Where do you find those? Say it again. So you find them in the Bible at the very beginning. The very beginning. Now, there's no law in Genesis, but most of Exodus, all of Leviticus, all of Numbers, and Deuteronomy. I love that word. It's a really tough word to spell, and I've had to spell it a lot in seminary. Correct. It is. Do you know why? Why they call it Deuteronomy? Because Moses is speaking it. So, let me show you up here. And this is, there we go. That is the law that Jesus is talking about. There's a lot there, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, my second question. There's a lot there. Why is Jesus so keen on making sure that the law doesn't go away, that the law be upheld? He uses his parables to explain them. But why doesn't he want them to get rid of? Why doesn't he want them to go away? Correct. He's not there to change them. I mean, they're God's laws, right? We're not allowed to touch those, right? I'm going to push back just a little bit, though, on Jesus and on God. So please let me do that. And if you don't mind, I'm kind of afraid of heights, so I'm going to come down the big mountain. So the real reason, or the main reason why Jesus doesn't want to get rid of the law and says we shouldn't get rid of the law and says we're going to keep it, I'm here to fulfill it, is that it's Israel's identity. Everything in the law, or the law is the covenant that that God made with the people of Israel after he led them out of Egypt, out of slavery. And it's even part of our identity, because Jesus said that it is our law, and it's not going anywhere. Do we follow most of it? No. Why? Anybody know?
Many of us have our own desires instead of overtaking the needs that have to be done in our house.
I like that answer. She said we have our own desires and our own needs. And there's another one. Most of that law deals with stuff that goes on in the temple. And the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. And that was the second time it was destroyed. Why are they still there? That one's rhetorical. Why are these books so still there? Why do we need them? I wonder, do we really know why they're there? And this kind of reminds me of a psychological experiment that I learned about when I was in undergrad. So there are five monkeys in a room. And there's a ladder in the middle of the room. And on top of the ladder, there's a banana. Now one of the monkeys runs towards the ladder, climbs up the ladder, and is about to grab the banana when icy cold water starts pouring from the ceiling, soaking all five monkeys. And this happens several times. All of the monkeys try to go up there and get it. Some of them try it more than once. Eventually, they realize that every time they go up the ladder and try to grab the banana, they get an icy shower. So eventually, the monkeys stop looking at the ladder. for fear that it might start raining. So then the scientists running this experiment start to change things. They take one of the monkeys out and replace it with a new monkey. And this monkey runs up to the ladder, and before she can grab the first rung, she is grabbed and thrown away by the other monkeys because they know what's going to happen. And so this cycle repeats until all five monkeys have been replaced. But those monkeys that have been replaced actually like join in. So when there's two monkeys that have been replaced and the third one comes in, those two monkeys are like, no, you can't go up the ladder. Eventually, all five monkeys are replaced, and none of those monkeys will touch the ladder. But none of those monkeys have ever had the icy shower. Now, I know that maybe science and monkeys aren't exactly best suited in church. So I'm going to try that story again, a little bit different. So a Methodist pastor was being followed around by a cat. And during the week, he didn't mind. You know, it's okay. You come follow me, cat. That's fine. You go where I go. But on Sundays, the cat would jump up on the altar, get into the communion stuff, jump up on the pulpit, knock everything over. It was a nuisance. But the pastor didn't want to get rid of the cat, really couldn't get rid of the cat. So he tied it up in the corner. And this happened for several years, until unexpectedly the pastor died. And the new pastor came in, and there was a cat tied up in the corner, and said, why do we have that? I said, well, you know, this cat is sort of the church cat. And you know, if we don't tie it up, it gets in the way. So they let the cat stay. And eventually, that cat died. And the people decided, we really need that presence. You know, that's such a part of our church to have a cat here. So let's put another cat there. They went out, they got another cat, they took care of it during the week, and they tied it up on Sunday. And for 120 years they did this. And to this day, that cat is still there. Or a cat, it's not the same cat. I would hope not. I want to know that cat's secret. But their local bishop recently came in and saw the cat tied up in the corner. And what's up with the cat? And came to the lay leader, and the lay leader's like, it's always been there. Always been there. I don't know. It's always been there. And that statement, it's always been like that. It's always been there. That is such a church statement, isn't it? Why do we use that baptismal font? Well, because it's always been here. Why do we use that pulpit? Well, it was given by so-and-so, and it's always been here. I don't really like that term, you know. Because they're empty words, you know. It's always been like that. Well, why? Why is it like that? I need to know this. You have to give, tradition is only good if there's meaning behind it. If it's tradition for tradition's sake, get it out of here. So, why do we have four books of law in the Bible that we don't follow? Because they've always been there. Well, I'm gonna let you all in on a little secret as to why they're there. So, when I look at today's scripture, I realize that Jesus is talking about how special Israel was, and I think I alluded to that earlier. Jesus is specifically talking to the Israelites and saying, you guys are God's chosen people. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. And to sum it up, Jesus said, you are God's chosen people. Don't forget that, and keep our traditions. Keep our traditions. Why did Jesus need to say, keep our traditions? Because keeping traditions is important. And there's a specific answer I'm looking for. It's one word. Starts with an R. Not respect. It's close. Well, it's a place. It's an empire. Rome. There we go. I knew we'd get there. So the Romans controlled all of the known world, essentially, in everything, pretty much. You know, God didn't, I know God gave Israel the promised land, and it's the promised land and everything, but it really, really isn't that great of land. It's a desert. It's in the worst possible location. You've got Rome and Greece to your northeast. You've got Syria and Persia to your northwest. You've got Egypt to your southeast. And all of those powers are trying to take over where everybody else is. And you're in the middle. Mm-hmm. So the way that I've described, or the way that I put into modern terms, or at least in Syracuse terms, is Israel's located underneath the 81-690 interchange. And the commuters come into your house and tell you what to do. You know? Like, it's awful. Like, this is my land. Let me stay here. You know, go somewhere else. But they just happen to be at the wrong place. So Egypt, again, Syria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome, all of these empires at one point controlled Israel. And they had various methods of controlling Israel. The Assyrians came in and they just destroyed the entire northern kingdom. Took out 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel, gone. Well, yeah, the Judah and I forget the other one. So there's the southern kingdom that actually goes into exile with Babylon. Babylon comes in and they just kind of went everywhere, all over the Babylonian Empire. And so the Israelites have been trying to define themselves in the midst of all of this different control. And that is why Jesus is saying the laws are important. Because people, the empires like Greece and Rome, really tried to get you to assimilate to what their culture was. But the Israelites were like, no, we're going to fight against this. We're going to fight against this. And so Jesus is there to say, we need to hold on to these traditions. These are our traditions. And they are good. And they are given to us by God. And we need to keep them. Jesus gave the reason. So Jesus says that the best way to keep the laws of Moses is in, you know, we're supposed to be the light of the world. We are the example to everybody else. But there's something funny about the laws of Moses that I haven't mentioned yet. There's a reason why they're in four books. It's because they're actually four different sets of laws. Not one. They're not one unified set of laws like all of the laws of the Constitution or the laws of New York State. They are five different sets of laws from five different time periods. So Israel has this tradition of having the laws of God change through time to meet the needs of what's going on. So Leviticus is about running the temple. How do you run the temple to be most efficient? That's right, Levi, Leviticus. They're the ones that run it. And in Deuteronomy, it's sort of creating a unified kingdom. So these laws came into existence. They were found in the temple by King Josiah, and he said, look what I just found. I found these new laws of Moses. We forgot about them. And he was the king of the southern kingdom after the northern kingdom had been wiped away, and he wanted to build a nation that was shepherds and make them into this really, you know, these shepherds live, you know, way out by themselves. He wanted to bring them together. So he centralized everything in Jerusalem and sort of created this law system around everybody comes to Jerusalem and practices there and meets everybody there, and we are one nation, and we will take back our land for God. So that's where those come from. So the people of Israel see these laws, and they go, okay, we have all these laws. Some of them sort of contradict each other sometimes, but not all of them have lost their saltiness. So I think we're gonna keep some of them. You know, they do that from time to time. They have to do that because, to borrow a line from Bob Dylan, times they are a changing. And so, as I said, the temple where the Israelites practiced was destroyed in 70 by the Romans after a failed insurrection, and so it came time again for the Israelites, for the Jews, to decide what their identity was going to be, because so many of these laws were designed to be done in the temple, and now there's no temple to do them in. So two identities actually arise from this destruction in 70. One of them is Rabbinic Judaism, which is still around today. It focuses on the teachings and the preachings of the rabbis. And the other one, anyone want to take a guess what it's called? Nope. It's called Christianity. So Christianity comes out of Judaism, and you know, we have this shared tradition of the law. And the Christianity says, okay, there's been something new has gone on, and we acknowledge that these laws were there at one point, but now we need to move towards something else, right? We're going to honor them. We're going to keep them. They're still there. But we don't necessarily need them anymore because God has done something new. So, again, teacher, history teacher, to be more specific. And so I'm reminded of another story, but really everything reminds me of a story, so please bear with me. Several years after World War II, a small group of Japanese soldiers was found on a very remote island. And they had been stationed there since the mid-1940s, and they really didn't have any communication with the outside world. So this is like the 1950s, and they're ready and waiting for that American landing craft to come up on the beach, and they're ready to fight, and it just never comes, and it never comes, and it never comes. And so finally, a Japanese boat comes, and they said, what are you guys doing here? It's like, well, we're ready to fight. I'm like, the war's been over for like 10 years. How did you not know? So a situation like that, it needs to be dealt with very delicately, because these are people who have been ready to fight Americans for 10 years. But if you recall history, Japan at that time was occupied by the United States. And if you were to bring those soldiers back and just put them to work, tensions would have been awful. There would have been riots. It would have been terrible. So the Japanese government did something very cool. They took these soldiers. They had this big public, very prestigious ceremony, and they said, "You guys did a great job, and we thank you. And we thank you. We honor your commitment to our country. But the war is over, and it's time to put ourselves back together. It's time to put the country back together. You're no longer our loyal soldiers. You are now our loyal workers." And so, relating this to the church, everything comes back to church because that's where we are, right? Are there tied-up cats in this church? Are there monkeys that won't reach for the banana? Are there loyal soldiers that need to be retired? I think there are. I think it's in this church. I think it's in our denomination. I think it is in all of Christianity. There are things that don't make sense anymore. So what do we do about it? Well, I know, like most people, change is scary. We don't know what's going to happen. We're afraid that people aren't going to understand where we came from. If we do something new, what about the old things that were good for us? Well, they were good then. And we need to honor that. We need to say, that was good then. Let's try something else. Let's see what works for today. So there should be in your bulletin, there should be a little piece of paper. Looks like this. And it's dissolving paper. So what I want you to do, take a few minutes as I finish, as I wrap up, and think about something in this church, in this denomination, in Christianity as a whole, that is a loyal soldier or a tied-up cat or a monkey that won't go up the ladder. And I want you to write it down. And then as you get up to leave, there are four stations where water is. And you find one of those, and you put it, stick the paper in the water, and it dissolves. I want you to give that to God. Okay? So let me tell you what mine is. So mine is that church worship is only on Sunday mornings. That doesn't work. I forgot something. I apologize. After you write this on your piece of paper, I want you to say a prayer. I want you to say a prayer of honor, a prayer of celebration, and a prayer of retirement for this tradition. So before I put this in the water, worship only being held on Sunday mornings, I say these words. God, I thank you for the gift of worship and for the first day of the week. In a slower time, this day was the perfect day for everyone to come and worship you, the divine giver of life. Help us now to move your church forward into the fast-paced, always open life of the 21st century. I invite you all to honor the past and live in today. Amen.